The John Campia Show, in association with Designing Hollywood, presents... Welcome to the Designing Hollywood Podcast. I am your host, Robert Meyer Burnett. The Designing Hollywood Podcast is dedicated to all things movies, the movie industry, and its talented professionals. Today's episode is sponsored by Paris Costumes. Our guest today is a Los Angeles-based award-winning costume designer who's collaborated on plays, feature films, short films, television movies of the week, and series projects, embracing contemporary, period, and fantastical scripts. A hardcore Star Wars fan, she joined the franchise during season 2 of The Mandalorian. This costume designer, known for her work on Disney's Mandalorian, said she tried to stay loyal to the original films, which, of course, we all love to hear. She won the Excellence in Sci-Fi Fantasy Television Award for her work on The Book of Boba Fett Chapter 1 at the 24th Annual Costume Designer Awards. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome award-winning costume designer Shauna Terpsich to the Designing Hollywood Show.
Thank you.
Now, before we start, you know, one of the great pleasures of this show is looking into people's backgrounds and looking at their IMDb and seeing, ooh, what did you work on that I happen to love? so I can break the ice, so to speak. Sure. And I was very surprised and delighted as I looked at your credits that you worked on what I consider to be one of the great unsung, I guess it's a B movie, but it's one of the great unsung action B movies of all time. This film is a masterpiece, directed by former second unit director Craig Baxley, turned director, stars a former Seattle Seahawk, Brian Bosworth, and has one of the great villain turns ever in any movie by Lance Henriksen. And I'm talking about Stone Cold. Now, I have to say, bravo, Stone Cold. So you worked on Stone Cold.
Yes, it was so much fun, too. I loved it.
Well, I have to say that kudos to you.
Thank you. It was fun. It was lovely. I loved it.
I mean, I look at your early career, and I mean, there, a lot of our audience, especially here, this airs now on the John Campia YouTube channel. We're all film fans. We do a lot of film shows. We're film pundits. And you, as far as us Star Wars, Star Trek, Joss Whedon, Firefly geek fans, your career is, I mean, you worked on The Core. Come on, the greatest Roland Emmerich movie he didn't make.
I was the assistant designer on that one.
I mean, and you worked on The Red Shoe Diaries.
I was on that with Zalman King.
Zalman King and Patricia Louise Knopp, Heroes of Mine. They made Two Moon Junction and, of course, 9 1/2 Weeks and Delta of Venus. Rest in peace, Zalman King. I'm a huge fan. He actually starred in the movie Blue Sunshine, if you've ever seen that, from the late 70s. If you haven't, check it out. What Lies Beneath you worked on, Payback you worked on.
Yep.
I mean, This Is the End, which I love. Good. And then I just look at your work as a costume designer. You did work on 40 episodes of Power Rangers, which who doesn't love that? Firefly. Did you design the original Power Rangers the way that?
Well, so they were originally designed in Japan, right?
Right.
And so I designed the original in America.
Yeah.
So I did the very first episode in the first 40 episodes.
Amazing. And then you worked on Firefly, which is, of course, I mean, one of the great cult TV series of all time that people still love. You did 37 episodes of Angel, which I loved. You did Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. I mean, come on. I mean, you must have been going to Comic-Con every year.
Yes, I've been quite often. I love it.
I mean, and you work with my man crush on Torchwood Miracle Day, Captain Jack Harkness. Come on. Yeah.
Went to Comic-Con with him, so that was really
fun. John Barrowman, the man, the myth. Yeah. And then, of course, Cabin in the Woods, Much Ado About Nothing. I mean, your work, your pedigree as far as, I don't know, the geek sphere, my sphere, the sphere a lot of us exist in, is impeccable.
Thank you.
But now, enough of that. People are like, Rob, come on. We all want to hear about Star Wars. And I'm like, so you find yourself working on the second season of Mandalorian, and you worked on, I believe, the entire season.
Yes.
So when you came on for the second season, and the first episode of the second season was The Marshal, where we're introduced to Cobb Vanth.
Can you even believe it?
I mean, Timothy Oliphant, come on.
Yeah.
First of all, tell us, how did they come for you?
It's a very funny story. There was a lawyer named Lynn Barch who was a fan of Firefly. I met her about 20 years ago, and she brought me down to Skywalker Ranch with the intention of, you know, hoping to get me plugged into their new production. And I ended up getting this huge tour and meeting everybody, and nothing came of it. Then about 18 years later, I get a random text says, are you available and are you interested in Star Wars? And Lynn introduced me to Colin Wilson, who then introduced me to Jon Favreau, who I then sat across the table with and talked about Star Wars with him and Dave Filoni for a couple hours, and I got the job.
Wow. Now, were you at all intimidated? I mean, this is a big franchise to jump on. I mean, yeah, you'd already done Firefly. You'd done Angel, so you'd done episodic genre programming that required you to come up with whether it was monsters or vampires or whatever. It wasn't out of your wheelhouse. Yeah. But coming onto Star Wars, how does that work? Like, do they take you into some magic room where they've got all the costumes? How did your Star Wars journey begin?
Well, I was in a magic room, and a lot of the art was already up and had been sort of thought out for the show. So Doug Chang and Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni sort of create the world that I kind of walk into. And then I take their research and their images and their inspiration, and I do my own research and put together my own inspiration and put together fabrics and do my own sort of deep dive into the history of Star Wars. I read every single making of book, and I took notes, every single thing that George Lucas told his designers, his creators, his artists to study and to look at. I got all of those same books and all of that same research, and I did a deep dive so that I too was standing on the same foundation as his original designers and his original artists, so that I would be coming from that same influence, that same sort of sphere of art. And I wanted to stay within, you know, 1977 to 1983, because that's kind of my timeline for The Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to use techniques, and I'm trying to stay, you know, I'm reading all these books, and, you know, how did they create this look? They weren't 3D printing. They weren't doing this. They weren't doing that. And I tried to use those same techniques, and it started to really ring true with everybody.
Well, I think you did a fantastic job. I mean, one of the great things, I mean, The Mandalorian obviously was immediately beloved, I think, by the Star Wars fan base, of which I, of course, am one of them. Now, the whole idea, before I ask you this question, let me ask you, how did you begin your career? You know, a lot of people always want to know, well, where did you start? Did you grow up a film fan? Did you have a background in art or art history? Where did all of this begin for you?
Well, I was a tomboy. I loved Star Wars, and to the point where I even watched Corvette Summer because I wanted more of Mark Hamill. I mean, I love Star Wars.
Corvette Summer's great. It recently came out on Blu-ray. Warner Archive released it, and you go back and watch it. Mark Hamill had great chemistry with Annie Potts.
Yeah, I love him. So I came from a background of loving film and being lost in film. I was glued to my TV every Sunday watching vintage films, but never would consider myself a film geek or an artist. I wanted to be a truck driver. I wanted to join the Army. I wanted to be a mechanic. That was my plan for leaving high school.
Wow.
Yeah, but my art teacher saw something in me in high school, and he said I had a stick-to-itiveness that with any sort of tradition that he tried to teach me, I would learn. I wouldn't quit until I learned it. So he said, just give me a chance, try to go to art school. If you get accepted, you know, you'll go. And I said, all right. So I got accepted to a couple of art colleges, and I didn't know what to major in, but he said, well, you like drawing the figure, you like working with the figure, why don't you go into fashion? And so I did that. And of course I knew nothing about fashion. I bought all my clothes at Army surplus stores, and I was very happy to do that. But I did learn. I would trace the best drawings after school, and I would, you know, study and find out who is Chanel and who is Gautier and all these different designers. And I did sort of fall in love with the fine art of creating the fashion, but I did get a job in fashion, and it was just to winter, spring, summer, fall, holiday, winter, spring, summer, fall, holiday, and you're really designing for one person, the customer who buys Chanel or the customer who buys Calvin Klein. And it was, I felt very boxed in as an artist. And then a friend of mine said that American Film Institute was training directors and producers how to make movies, and I should go and ask them if I could design their student films. So I went to the American Film Institute and I asked, I put together a portfolio. I took the book Moby Dick and I designed it like it was a movie, and I redesigned Motley Crue, and you know, so that my portfolio would show that I had range. And I went to American Film Institute and I asked the student directors.
Wait, hang on. Motley Crue, the band, like not like Captain Ahab's Motley Crue.
No.
But you had Moby Dick and Motley Crue, like Motley Crue.
In my portfolio, yes.
Wow. Okay.
And you know, I was at the time hanging out at the Whiskey Go Go and hanging out with like Guns N' Roses, hanging out with, you know, the Ramones or whatever, and you know, the Bengals. So I was sort of in that crowd. So my portfolio just showed that I could do research in time periods of Moby Dick, and it also showed that I could do heavy metal and rock. And
wow,
you know, and also just showed a sort of an arc of my artistic abilities, because I'm an illustrator. So I got the job designing student films. Basically, you work for free. I did that for a couple of years. Then they graduated, and I got my very first film where I got paid, which is a horror movie called Mom, which was amazing and great. I had to learn how to do blood continuity. I had to learn how to do, you know, heads cutting off and guts. And I worked my first 24-hour day in a row, and you know, had to like look in a mirror and remember who I was. And I was hooked. I absolutely loved it.
And let's see, that was that Patrick Rand directed that, and that was from 1991.
Yes, yes.
And Brian James was in it. The great Brian James.
He was amazing.
Stella Stevens too.
Yes.
And Claudia Christian.
She was Mom. Yes.
Again, your genre cred runs deep, Shauna. Deep.
And I loved it too, and so that's my people. So I enjoyed it.
Well, now that you were, I mean, things like blood continuity is important. I wonder if maybe touch on that a little bit, because when you're making a horror film and people do get blood on them, like how many of one costume would you have to make for something like that? Especially a low budget movie that you don't have enough money to make 10 of them.
For sure. Well, you know, like Mom's little nightgown, we probably had 5, but that was extremely low budget. For Cabin in the Woods, we had, I don't know, probably 15 copies of, you know, of those
sure.
clothes.
Well, you know, so you started out, I mean, your true LA roots. I mean, going from the Whiskey, I kind of did that. I was making, you know, low budget music videos for bands that couldn't pay us.
Exactly.
we'd go shoot them at the Whiskey a Go-Go, and they'd be like, yeah, we want to shoot on film. And we're like, great. And we'd shoot them on 16 and like, okay, but it's going to cost like $1,000 to process the film. Oh, we don't have that.
Yeah.
Aren't you guys taking care of that? And we're like, no. But
yeah,
those were the days. And then we were also working on low budget movies too. Now, let me ask you this. Before you were doing this, did you have touchstones, movies that you really admired? I mean, what were some of your biggest influences in terms of film?
So I really can't say, because honestly, that was never my sort of background. I went to movies because I loved them. So Escape from New York. You know, and of course, I fell madly in love with, you know, Kurt Russell and Star Wars, and I fell madly in love with, you know, Han Solo and Luke Skywalker. So I think a lot of my fandom was rooted in love, and, you know, like girl crushes. Smokey and the Bandit, you know, I think that's why I wanted to be a truck driver. And so as far as learning about film and the art of filmmaking, that didn't come until college. And then I really, really love Un Chenandalu, and you know, you get into Dali, and you know, you get into like the real art of making film, and then every single film I saw became a touchstone. Barfly to me is a piece of art, and you know, so I have an arc, you know. I had the little girl fandom, you know, love of film, and you know, Holly Golightly and things like that. And then when I got into college, it got darker.
Of course.
Yeah. And then I'm back. I think I'm back to my childhood roots of the awe and joy of filmmaking.
So now you're working on Mandalorian, and you know, you're going back to places like Tatooine or wherever, you know, and you get to create, like, in terms of Cobb Vanth, a character that we hadn't met in live action before. And Cad, oh, I mean Cad Bane. Well, we haven't got to Book of
I
Boba Fett yet,
know, sorry.
but my God, what a great when he strolls in out of the sands. I mean, it was.
Yeah, it's Boba Fett, yeah.
But when you started, and obviously there's a huge heavy pre-design element to all of that. How much are you able to then bring forward? Do you get to say choose fabrics? And like you were talking about earlier, all of this research that you did was when you were doing the research. I mean, there's so many reference books. I myself have nine Art of Star Wars books, and then there's the Art
Well,
of
I
the
got
Clone Wars and the Art of yeah. There's it's just
I
it's
wish I could show you my bookshelf at work. It's awesome.
oh, I'll bet. I mean, and then there's the Chronicle books, and then the new Toshin books, the Star Wars archives.
Even Star, even the video games, all of them are magical, so.
Yeah. Now, how do you begin? I mean, in terms of what you would normally do with all of this stuff that has been pre-designed, was that at all frustrating or was it liberating? Was it joyous? What was it
Well,
like?
I mean, for me, because I've been to Comic-Con for so many years, I know the importance of being loyal to where the dent goes and how far it is from the first scratch. But what was very freeing for me is that he'd been through the Sarlacc pit. So I got to start from my own choices, my own, choices for everything. I did lots of research for color and I did lots of research and, I used ironing cover material for his vest because that would be fireproof and that made sense. And so I didn't do what any of the fans said. I didn't do what any of the any of the cosplay things say. It, as much respect that I have for the 501st and everybody else, I just wanted to start in my own sort of world where I was. And I created Boba Fett from the ground up. The hair, for his tassels, I did all the research on where it was actually from. Some say Wookiee and some, all these different.
Well, you can't say that anymore because it's not, it's Disney.
Right, right.
He doesn't have Wookiee scalps. That's not
Right.
Slave Leia. That's
Well,
Hutt Slayer Leia.
right. But so I do all my own research and I didn't go to any of the fan boards and I didn't listen to anybody but George, quite frankly, George Lucas. And then once I took it from the foundation, then I bring it to, Doug Chang, and I bring it to Jon Favreau, and I bring it to Dave Filoni, who are the keepers of the torch. And those guys are so knowledgeable and so full of rich history that they're not going to let me mess up. And but they give me a lot of freedom because after a certain point, they do trust that I'm not going to bring them something without doing my homework. But I'm no, and by no means as knowledgeable as someone like Doug Chang, who's been there since 1993, and Dave Filoni, who's an encyclopedia, and Jon Favreau, who's just this artistic genius. And so, it's very liberating to know that I have a foundation that will hold me accountable. But we are starting from scratch. Like I
Right.
said, coming from the Sarlacc pit, there's no guide to that. There's no key to that. So. I have a lot of freedom within these very sort of hard boundaries, but there's tons of freedom within those boundaries.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was really striking was the introduction of Boba Fett in Mandalorian season two. I mean, when he shows up, he's not wearing his armor. He's wearing these black, and we don't know. I'm curious. We don't know where those black robes had come from when we're watching The Mandalorian. Did you know when Boba Fett was introduced, the origin of those black robes?
I absolutely did not. John keeps his stories very close to his heart. Even now, like he's working on two or three different shows, and you're just like, "Tell me more," because we're all dying to know. But he did give me Lawrence of Arabia, which was originally designed by Phyllis Dalton, and so I did go to Omar Sharif's character is specifically that the man in the desert. Yes. So that was and Mad Max, obviously designed by Claire Griffin, and so I did my research from those original designers, from that original thought of the mysterious man from the desert, and
Okay.
that's Boba Fett. That's Boba Fett coming out of there, and that was all inspired by John's direction.
I mean it was so I mean I think I speak for every Star Wars fan watching the second season of Mandalorian, having Boba Fett show up. That was like the most badass thing ever. And he was badass in the show. Now I'm curious, I mean, obviously Boba Fett is a fighter. So when you were creating, in terms of like the fabrics, was it a hard choice to make in terms of fabrics you were going to use for that black, that desert? How did you come to the fabrics that you used?
So again, I went back to Omar Sharif, and when you get close to him, there's these magnificent textures, almost a hand woven, a sense of everything coming from the desert, coming from the woolly, you know, tauntaun, or not tauntauns, but you know what I mean? But coming from the desert floor.
Dewbacks, or the dewback lizards, or the banthas, of course.
The not in the snow.
The banthas.
There we go, the banthas. And so there's a process of rolling the wool and then weaving the wool. And I wanted to communicate that he's really built himself up from nothing in the desert. And so I was looking for those textures. I found them in silks and wools, and then washing them and aging them and sanding them. Carol, my brilliant ager dyer, just tortured over that until we found it.
Wow. Yeah. Cause that was really amazing. Now, you know, in the second season you had other, like Bill Burr, his character,
such a great actor.
He was so, one of my favorite scenes is when he sits down with that Imperial officer and they go mano y mano.
So much tension there. It was so beautiful.
Well, one of the things that also, in terms of Imperial stuff, there's a lot of different kinds of stormtroopers and different armors that were sort of introduced, and different Mandalorians. I mean, you worked on the second season, so they already had like the armor introduced and the heavy Mando,
And those were all designed with Legacy and Joseph Porro and Doug Jones. I mean, Doug Jenks.
Doug Jones. That's a different franchise.
That's a different franchise. Sorry.
So when you were brought on, were you looking forward? I mean, being a fan of this stuff already, did you want to design like a new stormtrooper or some kind of an armor or put some, because there's different colors on the armors, you know, depending on what they do and things that we hadn't seen before. There's yellows and reds and things used on the armor. Was that stuff that you got to participate in?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I did really get to do, which is now, you know, into Star Wars mythology, is that I was able to remix the mixture of the stormtroopers' armor. Whereas before, in all of Star Wars, stormtroopers have never really been able to go upstairs or downstairs and had a very sort of clanky walk or run. And we needed stormtroopers needed to go up rocks, you know, and so, they needed to climb up rocks. And so my specialty team and I just came up with this mixture where we would get the hard armor, but it would give it a certain amount of flexibility so that our stunt folks could get up the mountains. So we started something new with that kind of armor. And I got to tell you, I love doing stuff like that. And you know, like I think John said that he wanted so-and-so kind of a trooper to come in. And then it's researching what are those colors and what is the markings of those colors? And are we starting something new? And if we're starting something new, what is the history? What is the future of it? And I love getting into that. I've always been a super history buff. And so now I'm just, I don't know, transferring that delight in accuracy, but also reinventing into the Star Wars history.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you did such a great job. And that's one of the great things about watching this show is like, ooh, what are they going to make next? You know, does a high-end toy company like Hot Toys, are they going to make that armor? And the answer is usually yes. My pocketbook.
I know. Hot Toys Ahsoka is gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, it's stunning. But you also, you know, as you move through The Mandalorian, we saw, we got to go to different locations. We saw different things. And then, of course, at the end, we see the return of a certain Jedi, you know, a favorite Jedi of ours.
Oh, no. Can you believe that?
No. No, I don't think any of it. We were all like our jaws hit the floor when that happened. And I think that, you know, again, obviously these are designs that have been set. But for, say, Mark Hamill coming back and then playing that, and then they had obviously another actor in Book of Boba Fett as well. Did you reuse old costumes or did you go back and create something new?
Oh no, it's all brand new. So every drape, every fold is new, and it's new to his character because he's been through a long journey. Again, there is a history, but he's in a new place. He is a new person. He's gone through his training. He's, I don't know, he's refined, if you will. So I was loyal to what we've seen before, but I reinvented it. And we did a whole new style for every time we see him. I touch it a little bit more with the kind of Star Wars magic. And, you know, Mark Hamill was there. I was sitting on the floor in his dressing room while he, you know, sat at his desk, and we talked it through. And this is a very, very important part of him. And obviously incredibly important to John and Dave and Doug. And my tailor at the time was Marianne Parker, and we were literally taking these different silks, and we had all the measurements laid out for us. Skywalker Ranch did all the research. That we had every measurement of the original black outfit, and so we took the foundation of the reality of the history, and then we built on it and layered it and made it a little more royal, a little more I don't know, significant, if you will, if that's the right word. For his return. And what's hysterical is that Colin Wilson wouldn't tell me who the costume was for. And I was making it in two different sizes, one for our gentleman and one for mysterious person. And I said, well, will you be needing one glove or two? And he's like, forget it. So clearly we knew who it was for, but it was a name that could not be said. And it was such an honor. And they brought the costume to him over Christmas vacation. John and Dave brought it to him, and he put it on, and he rehearsed in it, and he spoke the lines in it. And that's a career maker right there. That's a joy that I get to take with me forever.
Wow. That's just, I can't even imagine what it was like seeing Luke walk out in a costume that you'd made. Yes, the evolution, sir. The evolution of his Jedi outfit from the end of Jedi, Return of the Jedi, in 1983.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it's it's incredible.
Yeah.
Now, what about the others? I mean, obviously, as the series evolved, we saw more and more Mandalorians. We saw the group. Actually, that final episode had a lot of different. You had Mandalorian armors. You had Luke come back. You are dealing with the Grogu puppet, there's so many different things. What in terms of the Mandalorian? What was one of your favorite things to design that maybe people didn't necessarily see or know because it wasn't front and center? Did you get to do a lot of other little pieces and things that don't always show up on camera but are there that only you might have known about?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we get a lot of the costumes, sort of background costumes and extra stuff from all the shows, whether it be Rogue One or Force Awakens. So at the time, not a lot of other Star Wars shows were going on. And so they just kind of sent a big load to us. And what I do was I would go through and I would find details, quiltings or stitchings or just how things were solved back in 1970, back in 1983, or, you know, for Force Awakens. And I would apply certain techniques to even the background that you would see so that somewhere in the back of your consciousness, it's ringing true that you're in the right time period or that you're in the right world. And this is Star Wars. So I snuck in a lot of hidden gems that people might, I mean, if they really study it, which they do, they'll recognize, oh, that's from that coat. And that's from, you know, I mean, somebody noticed on Cobb Vanth that I had used this box that was from another costume. And I thought that was cool.
Yeah, they know. I mean, yeah. you mentioned early on the 501st. If anybody's going to know this stuff, the 501st is going to be like, oh.
I love it. Well, and of course, our actors is from the 501st. And so we have long, long, long talks, you know, in conversations. Paul, who plays one of our X-Wing pilots.
So when Mandalorian season 2 ended and you knew, did you know that there was, they obviously announced the Book of Boba Fett in that last episode, that it was coming out. How long was it between the end of production of Mando season 2 and Book of Boba Fett season 1?
Well, we had, the pandemic had just started when we wrapped. And so none of us knew what was going on. You know, that was it. I just moved into a new house with my kids, and it was like, okay, how are we going to pay the rent here? And you know, we get very practical. But then I I got a call, I think, from Julie Robar, the costume supervisor, and she says, "You know, I think, you know, we're gonna move forward with prepping." And so I called Colin Wilson and I said, "I would love 2 or 3 days just to start sketching, you know, just, you know, because I know there'll be a new Boba Fett. I know you mentioned Tuskens, and if I could start getting those scripts, you know, I'm hyper focused. You can pay me for 3 days, but I'll work for, you know, whatever." It's like, you know, we didn't say all that, but you know, it's like, I want something to keep my brain out of this pandemic. And, you know, we're making masks for, you know, nurses and doing everything that everybody was doing. And then I got a call saying, "Here you go." And the scripts just started spilling in and I was transported.
Well, one of the first things that I thought was really cool is that you created, I mean, obviously the Tusken Raider costume really hadn't changed much since the original Star Wars. And yet you created almost, an entire Tusken realm. I mean, you got to create all different characters that had to be delineated, new tribes, new colors, new things like that. How did you begin? And again, I have to ask about the influences. Where did you start creating and making something that we knew that was obviously recognizably Tusken, but yeah. Now we had to know who the different characters were. There were different characters within the tribes. And yeah. I thought you did a wonderful job.
Sure.
I loved the Tusken costumes that you made for Book of Boba Fett. And how did that begin? What was that process like?
Well, you know, what John does with like Doug Chang and Lucasfilm is, you know, they do broad strokes, you know, so they had in that spot a classic Tusken, you know, in the tan costume. But I needed a backstory because when Boba Fett came out of the desert, he was in all black. And so I couldn't sort of validate that he, because now I knew that he was coming from this tribe that had saved him. And I was like, well, then I need to incorporate black into their costume so that we know that he's from them. And one of John's directives was he needed them to be individually recognized, because so often the Tuskens have been the bad guys and you're just popping off shapes. But now we really need to care. We need to be invested in them as individuals. And I was like, well, one way I can do that with coloration and you know, in the desert, like going back to Mad Max, you know, he picked up, you know, a whistle and a boatswain whistle. And he had little things that he felt precious that he would sort of attach to his clothes that would just travel with him. And so I wanted to find, you know, other sort of nomad tribes. There's the Blue Men of Morocco. There's, you know, Native Americans. There's, you know, the Amazons. There's many different, incredibly beautiful, rich groups of people who can be a little bit nomadic, and so will travel with their art and with their treasures on them. And so I wanted to find a way to incorporate that into this Tusken group. And you know, one of the things that a lot of these different groups would do would sort of paint their clothes, and it would sort of ombre. It would be lighter on top and go into darker colors towards the bottoms, and they would use clay and the charcoal from the fires to color their costumes. So I kind of started with the classic Tuscan. I started with a classic tan, and then I worked in black and I worked in red clays, and I tried to picture only things that they could have achieved on Tatooine, which is a very desert, very dry universe. And so to me, burning wood, you would get the charcoals, and clay you can mix with berries and make the reds. And so I slowly found that, and I liked the idea of the original female Tuskens had that shawl. So I made sure that all the females had that shawl. And so it took a while, but people realized that the main warrior was female because she was wearing, you know, the feminine shawl. And so I tried to find things that were established through the history of Star Wars so that people knew these are Tuskens, like all other Tuskens. They have just sort of evolved a little bit in their heart and their love.
Yeah, and then, which was great. I mean, I thought you did a wonderful job doing that. I thought the look of the Tuskens were great. And then obviously we see later in Boba Fett's backstory, as he sort of ingratiates himself, he's captured, but then he ingratiates himself to this tribe. And then we learn about his black undergarments, like the origin of those undergarments. Now, as you said, you didn't know what that origin was when you're working on Mando season 2, but were you surprised to find out where this black undergarment had come from, and like that it was traditional garb that you were presented. You know, you had to earn it. It was an honorary, very, very much an honor. Was that surprising when you read that in a script? Like, oh,
Oh no, it was like, oh my goodness, I'm glad I took the time to make that final costume really special, because here it is. It's being draped on him in this onerous way. And John let me participate in the dance of that ceremonial dressing. So I had a couple of background people that were going to actually be dressing Boba Fett, who are Tuskens, and I showed them sort of the very traditional way of laying on the clothes and laying on the armor, and I watched some samurai dressings and some royal dressings to make sure that the actions were sort of smooth and almost ballet like. But that I got to tell you, when we were doing that, even just rehearsing it in front of John, I got the chills, and it was, you know, he creates these worlds. He creates these worlds that we get to, I don't know, live in while we're creating them. And it's a truly magical experience. And I know that is translating onto the screen, because you see all the love. I mean, everybody on the show is a fan. You know, we all wear Star Wars every day. And I think it really goes. It really does.
Well, it's probably, of all the TV shows that have ever been made, it's unique in that there's so much lore and so many costumes and so much reference work that you can go back to and look at and then expound upon and change. Now, one of the things that both delighted and well, the denizens of Mos Espa, I can't believe Jennifer Beals, Miss Flashdance herself, who everyone fell in love with in 1983, is now a Star Wars, well, she's now a dead Star Wars character, I think, maybe. I loved, she's a Twi'lek. And I mean, I loved her again, casinos or nightclubs or wherever are part of their Star Wars staple all the way back to Mos Eisley's Cantina. What was it like starting to, I mean, her whole club was populated with delicious costumes. And for you, you know, when you read that in the script, what did it say? Like, did you have, I mean, obviously there was production art of this, so you could consult, but still, I mean, did you go hog wild in there or Bantha wild, I guess you'd say, because it's on Tatooine? I mean, what was it like to be given, I mean, this is not a small scene. There's people that polish your helmet. You know, there's people that, what was that like?
Well, I wanted to, the polishing the helmet toy, like I wanted to base that on Princess Leia and her slave costume, because these Twi'leks are redeemed. They are traditionally known as a slave race. And I wanted to show, especially Jennifer Beals, who had come up with her backstory of being exonerated and earning her freedom and then, you know, coming into this great power. So she was magical to work with. And so she sort of heightens the bill of creating the world around her. Who would be drawn to her? The most exquisite gamblers, the most elegant women, the most powerful landowners. And then you're just, you know, your cats like in Vegas who just come off of the strip who are just, you know, there to gamble and drink. Right. So I wanted, you know, Star Wars is very good at creating that arc of humanity. And that's what makes it so real. You know, it takes a diverse community, you know, in my group of designers and people who work with me to create a diverse and realistic community on camera. And so I have Gio and Frederick and Lawrence and so many others who are my costumers who help me pull together these different looks. And they all come from different backgrounds. And so with their help, I create boards of what I'm looking for and I shop and I have things made. And then I rely on my costumers to help me create this arc of this world, this believable world that's coming from different cultures, you know, from the Latino point of view, from the Black point of view, from the white point of view, from the gay point of view, from every single point of view. And then the world comes alive when hair and makeup all and props all come together and you see them and you're just, it was amazing. And then we got to do like three story days of that. You usually don't get to change clothes in Star Wars. And so being able to have her have three different looks and creating the crowd three times and who is that crowd each time that Boba Fett comes to visit was a huge task. But I got to tell you, the support of my costumers made it made it seem easy.
I mean, you must have had, like, I can only imagine the joy. It's like, ooh, we can just make up Star Wars costumes for people that someone's going to make an action figure of later.
Right, right. You know? I do think of that. And I do think of my cosplayers. I'm like, you know, like on Ahsoka, I said, let's put in this little detail right here, because that's going to drive them crazy. And only the cosplayers are really getting really close with the magnifying glass. I love every level of cosplay. I respect them so, so greatly. But so I like to sort of up the challenge as you get better and better at the tasks. I put in things there that you'll only find with a magnifying glass.
Then you also got to, there's new characters. I guess people are calling them the Mos Espa Vespa gang.
Yes.
Your Mos Eisley, or it's Mos Espa. It's not the Mos Espa, or unless they came from Mos Eisley and moved to Mos Espa, you know, because the pickings were better there. I don't know.
The mods.
Now, a lot of people talked about, like, is this Quadrophenia? You know, old school fans like myself would be like, come on, how do you not know Quadrophenia? Sting was in Quadrophenia. Yeah. But what were the influences for the Mos Espa Vespa mod gang?
Quadrophenia. Definitely the movie Quadrophenia, but also definitely the idea of even our modern day youth, people are you know, putting things in their skin and putting horns on, and the idea of you know, how people are so prejudiced against droids that, you know, people would start sort of removing their own hand to have a droid hand, and how shocking that would be, as just like, you know, back in the day when tattoos would have been shocking. So now these guys are actually removing parts and putting in sort of robotic parts or droid parts. Whereas like the older generation is very prejudiced against droids, and this new generation is not only not prejudiced, but also embracing their parts and putting them into their body. So they were supposed to be kind of a shocking, edgy group. And I loved them. I loved every part of them. And I loved the juxtaposition of their brightness and their loudness against, you know, our desert Tatooine, because a community has to evolve. And to me, they're sort of an evolution that would probably be more, you know, comfortable on a Glabbus type, you know, spinning spaceport, but they're here, they're on a desert. It's
right.
Town, yeah.
And it's interesting, because, like, saying that, now that it never really occurred to me that because you've got the tattoo parlor, but instead of a tattoo parlor, you know, they're taking body parts, or they give Fennec Shan an entirely midriff of turning her into half machine.
She's a mod now.
She is a mod. Literally, the word mod becomes, you know, mm-hmm. a different. It's interesting, because
a modified character.
Yeah, a modified character instead of somebody who's modern. As opposed to rocker. That's, you know what? I don't know why that never occurred to me till right now.
Well, that's John. That's his words. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't, I don't know why. Perhaps I haven't read my Art of Book of Boba Fett yet. But that's, so again, when you're looking at fabrics and things like that, I mean, obviously clothing in terms of the mods in Quadrophenia was a big deal. Did you have sort of a design philosophy, but what kind of clothes that these groups would embrace, like in terms of fabrics and things like that?
Yeah, that was definitely a huge challenge, and John definitely threw down the gauntlet with that, because, you know, that sort of look has never been in Star Wars before, and
right.
I wanted to be very loyal to my community and very loyal to Star Wars, and I didn't want to slip into futurism, or I didn't want to slip into a different genre. So again, it's staying loyal to shapes. It's staying loyal to things I've seen before in Star Wars, but using new fabrics. And so, you know, how can I use new fabrics without being modern? So I went to a vintage raincoat manufacturer in England, where all the original Star Wars fabrics were from England. And on one side is rubber, and on the other side is this beautiful old wool. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, that's totally what they would have used in 1977 to create a modern look. And so the slickers are made out of this you know, fabric that is both modern and vintage at the same time. And so I try to stay with all their fabrics. They're both modern and vintage. Nothing is sci-fi. Nothing is plastic. You know, it's all stuff that had been used, you know, back in the 70s and 80s.
Wow. And now, in terms of a color palette,
yes.
Obviously, there's a lot more color in those characters than there, and same in the nightclub, than you would see from, say, the Tuskens and all that. But did you have a certain color palette in mind, or how did color work for you in those things?
Yeah, for Garza's, it was more jewel tone. So that was sort of set by Andrew Jones and Doug Chang, because they were going very gold and very Casablanca with green plants and gold walls for Garza's palace. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to put her in white was, again, Humphrey Bogart. But I wanted everyone around her to sort of sparkle and be jewel tones to really pop against the gold, and also just to be almost like a treasure chest in a desert sand, you know, where it just really pops and is really different. So with the mods, I wanted to sort of strip away the color. They're sort of grays and whites, except for like sort of the hot reds that you would sort of recognize on a droid rather than on any of the humans. So where they went sort of mechanic reds and mechanic yellows and sort of acid greens, whereas Garza's is more the jewel tones.
And, you know, I did like the sort of the aristocratic crowd in Mos Espa, you know, your mayor, like you're saying, did they have, like, I did love the design of the mayor. I thought he was great. But the design work I really thought was effective. I mean, we've sort of seen, beginning with the prequels, you saw like the Trade Federation, you saw the denizens, the royalty from Naboo, and you've seen Leia from Alderaan and even her father. And there's been sort of an interesting royal strata that has been weaved throughout the Star Wars world, the aristocratic or the political. Yeah. And I guess the higher up Imperial officers would be part of that as well, too. Is there a guiding design philosophy, you know, in terms of that, like when you're dealing with rich or powerful aristocrats or governmental figures, is there a mandate in how they're supposed to look at all? I don't know.
I did go back to the original sketches of Ralph McQuarrie, and he did explore the upper echelon, that level, and so I did find and I can't remember the creatures. I'm totally blanking on their name, but I based them off this one creature, and they had these sort of long drapes and these very sort of Art Nouveau lines, and it was Frank Lloyd Wright, and so I tried to choose those lines and those shapes for Merrimack Shays and his two guards.
Well, that's really, see, again, I'm glad we're having this conversation, and you know, I think that people don't understand a lot of the time that even though Star Wars is an established universe, how much you come in can add to it and greatly advance the lore without people understanding or knowing that that's what's going on. And I think one of the most fun things about watching these Star Wars shows, and I'm looking forward to it. I mean, we've got Andor coming, we've got the Acolyte coming, there's the Ahsoka show coming. Can you say whether or not you'd be working on any of these upcoming shows? Okay. Well, then we'll move right on. that's very exciting to hear. So, but I think that that's one of the great things about Star Wars is it's this expanding, living, breathing universe. And one of the great things about Mandalorian and Book of Boba Fett, I mean, my Hot Toys budget was destroyed just through Mandalorian armor alone.
Yeah.
You know, between I mean, the Death Mando, the Armorer. Thank God I bought the Heavy Mando because they didn't make many of them.
You
know?
Sorry, I have to.
Oh, look at that. There's your Hot Toys. Now, let me ask you something. What's it like? See, look at that. Look at that Hot Toy. Look at that beautiful.
Isn't it amazing?
I mean, those Hot Toys figures are great. Now, when you've worked on something and then Hot Toys then later, because we haven't got a Cobb Vanth figure, but they've teased it. They're going to make one.
Yeah.
And when something that you've created gets, because not many costume designers get the joy of getting a high-end toy company making a $250 or $300.
Even just fan-made stuff like this. I love it so much.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Now, you know, they just released the Boba Fett 2-pack. Hot Toys did that has the Boba Fett in the traditional robes that was from Mando season 2, and then the full on Boba Fett costume.
Try to find someone to get that for me.
it's spectacular, but so like knowing that you're doing that, does it ever weigh on you, the responsibility?
Oh no, I love that. I said, okay, now remember this has to be iconic. Remember the toy. We're creating a toy here, and. And I have this new tailor who came over. He's from New York. Um, he he was a friend of one of my set people. He wasn't in the union. He had only worked on Broadway for years. And secretly, I didn't know, but he's a huge, huge fan. Like he knows, you know, he knows every single detail about Ahsoka. And now he's actually, you know, got to work on, you know, fixing up her stuff from season two. So, you know, it's wonderful to be a part of this community that wants to create. And as he was draping and as he was building this other character, I said, remember, she's going to be a toy. And he just about started crying. He's like, I can't even believe I'm here right now. And I do, it doesn't weigh on me. It's a joy. I did get to go visit Sideshow Collectibles and see Ahsoka as she was being developed. And I got to talk with the artist who hunted down and recreated the fabric for her pants. And I was just so honored, you know, because we took the same time to hunt down and create the fabric for her pants too, you know. And so to have them do it in, you know, 1/16th scale or whatever it is, it's such an honor. And we're all artists. We're all playing off of each other's gifts. And so I find it a very nice community to live in. Right. And not threatened.
Now, there's, you know, obviously, when you were doing Book of Boba Fett, I don't know, was Andor shooting, because they're shooting in London.
Yeah.
And were they shooting concurrently with...
You know, I don't know. I did see, like, fan pictures, you know, people, like, taking pictures from the beach of Andor. So I do think it was at the same time.
Right.
But I honestly don't know.
Now that you've got different shows being made by different crews, different people, is there... I mean, obviously, I guess the design team headed up by Doug Chang, it would be I guess it's kind of a different, Andor would take place, what, 10 or 15 years before Book of Boba Fett?
Yeah.
So, but is there, do you guys have like, is there like a costume designers conference? Do you guys like once a month get on a Zoom call and trade stories or information or trade different, like, hey, you might want to like incorporate, because you're 15 years in the future, you might want to incorporate this in the next season. Do you guys do any of that?
I have met with two of the designers for a couple of shows. What we share more often is, hey, you had an Ithorian on your show. Can I borrow the pattern so I can just design off that? You know, we share alien patterns. More because we are kind of all in slightly different time periods. And honestly, you know, I think Doug and one other person kind of, they're the, you know, the stable art influence on all these different shows. So that they stay loyal, but then each designer is going to bring her own artistic inspiration, her own use of fabrics, her own use of history. So I think you are going to, and we are all different time periods, which is great. So you are going to get different flavors and different tastes and different beauties. But no, we tend not to talk on creative levels. One, because we're signing NDAs, and all of our shows have a lot of private information.
Yeah,
but. Mainly when they call me, it's honestly to share, you've already solved the Ithorian problem. You know, can we borrow just the basic pattern so that we can build our design off knowing that it needs to be this shape and it needs to go over these kind of feet and these kind of arms. It's more, I guess, the mechanical information that we share.
Right. Well, you know, another thing that we got to see in Book of Boba Fett was the return of the Gamorreans. You know, and you got, and this time, I mean, the Gamorreans and Jedi didn't have to move that much,
right.
Your Gamorreans were walking around and they were kicking ass and they were doing all kinds of things. Was there a reconceptualization in terms of the Gamorrean costume, the thinking behind the Gamorreans?
They redesigned and repurposed that body so that we could get a more consistent body for these guys because of the stunts and because of having to use so many pads. I mean, literally one fell down some stairs and these guys were brilliant, but you do feel it even in the padding. So we needed to make sure that we could fit all the stunt pads in the costume. And we redesigned the costume as well. John had a maquette from the original, I don't know if it was Ralph McQuarrie or who designed the original sketch, but it was, you know, with that little X design for the costume.
And
he's like, I want him to look like this. And so, you know, that was our inspiration for the new Gamorreans on the new body to do that.
Now, do you have, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, obviously that the way they used to make TV shows on each studio lot, they would constantly borrow, you'd see props show up in 10 different shows and things like that. So it makes sense when you have when you're sharing effects teams or people, why wouldn't you avail yourself of those
Legacy
things?
Legacy is a treasure trove of just gifted artists and knowledge. And so we work really, really closely together. Like when I came in on season two, they had already built the Mandalorian. They'd already solved a lot of problems. And then I came in from a designer's point of view of making the actor comfortable and being able to move better within that armor. And so a lot of our gifts are constantly, overlapping. And, what we were working on recently, it was the same thing. It's a true partnership. And we do, because they do have a treasure trove of knowledge of many different shows and having already solved a lot of different problems. And then I come from the designer point of view of being able to tell you, a person needs to be able to do this and they have to be able to do this. And I need this kind of movement. And the fabric needs to tell this kind of history. And they meet me halfway. It's beautiful.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, listen, this has been a fascinating conversation. And I would love to just before, there's probably a lot of people out there, especially with Star Wars. It probably got a lot of people into, looking at John Mollo's costumes from the original and looking at all this design work.
Yeah.
Then there's probably, you did that. And there's probably people that are looking at your work now, young impressionable fans that are thinking they want to get into design.
And I got a Star Wars celebration. I'm so excited.
Oh, that's the end of May.
Yeah,
it's very exciting. Are you going to have a booth there? Can people find you at Star Wars Celebration? Are you doing a panel?
I had to buy tickets. I actually had to buy tickets for me and my kids. So
you had to buy tickets to Star Wars Celebration?
Yes, I did.
Oh, man. I would think that...
I'm going as a fan, too, so...
They should make you a judge for the costume contest or something.
That would be fun, yeah.
So let me ask you this. Obviously, I love your unconventional, the idea that you were designing for Moby Dick and Motley Crue, I love this idea. What would you recommend? Obviously, you didn't have the strict academic background that a lot of designers have had, but what would you recommend in terms of where does somebody start if they wanted to get into the profession?
Well, I do have a bachelor's degree in fine art that I got from Otis.
You did? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I did go there for 4 years studying fashion and fine art and decided to go into costume. left it all. I would say working on student films is a great place to start. There's people at UCLA. There's people at American Film Institute. There's people at USC. Film schools. And they're going to need designers and they're going to need people. And I learned from the bottom up. I've held boom, which is the sound mic. I've done everything on a film set, and I found that really, really helpful. So yes, I have the artistic background. Yes, I have. I know how to pattern make. I know how to sew. I know how to draw. I know how to paint. And I'm, getting really familiar with digital, even better digital drawing. So I say the academic background is invaluable, and because that's where I fell in love with film. In the artistic way. But then it's just getting your hands dirty. It's just getting on a student film and learning how to, do everything. And that keeps you humble too. You know what every job takes. And so you never take it for granted, the work that your team is doing for you.
Right. Now, do you still keep up? A lot of people have talked to me about how they go to art museums when they go around the world, and they're the grand masters, the way they use color and light is very helpful. Oh, you are.
If you follow my Instagram or Facebook or something, I'm still very close with my high school art teacher, and so at least once a month we go to a museum together. So I'm very much very involved in the arts, and I also go to gallery openings and support young artists, I buy paintings of young artists, and they're hanging in my house, and tomorrow I'm going to the LA County Art Museum with my neighbor and my daughter, and my favorite museum is the Chicago Art Institute. And so I think it's imperative as an artist to constantly be surrounded by the masters, and more importantly, what the 13-year-olds are working on, what the 16-year-olds are working on, what the 18-year-olds are working on. And even in my team, I try to surround myself with every age group, from the senior citizen down to the person who 18 years old, who's just brand new off the college circuit. Mm-hmm. Because you never stop learning. And if you don't surround yourself with every genre, with every race, with every, you know, background, you're going to miss out and you're not going to be able to create a full world, you know, artistically. So yeah, I try to hone my skills every day.
Where can people follow you on social media?
At Terpsic, at T-R-P-C-I-C is my Instagram. And I think just Shauna Terpsic or at Terpsic on Facebook.
Okay, that's fantastic. Well, Shauna Terpsic, I can't tell you how much fun this conversation has been.
I've been too.
I've managed to keep my geek in check, which and not and not ask too many probing questions you couldn't answer, but so enlightening, so much fun to talk to you. And thank you so much for being a part of the Designing Hollywood podcast.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure.
And a very special thanks to our sponsor, Paris Costumes. Paris Costumes has been a part of the history of the European theater, film, and television industry since 1856 and became 21st century tailors. They are known for being experts in hiring and producing costumes of all periods. Paris Costumes' aim is to become a 21st century costume house through innovation while maintaining the standards of tradition and quality gained over years since 1856. They offer a variety of services, fabrics, accessory samples, leatherwork, hats, shoes, uniforms, period pieces. Paris Costumes, a costume rental house for film and television. A special thanks to our producer and founder, Martika Ibarra, and of course, our co-founder, legendary costume designer, Marilyn Vance, and our new partner, John Campia of the John Campia YouTube channel. Thank you to all of our viewers for tuning in, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and hit that notification button, and you can find the Designing Hollywood podcast wherever you get your podcasts, also on iTunes. Follow me, Robert Meyer Burnett, on Instagram, on Twitter at BurnettRM, or find me on my own YouTube channel, The Burnett Work. Thanks for watching. We very much appreciate it.